Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh is death, and he is coming. Inevitably, he is coming. He will not stop, and he will not be killed, and it's inevitable. Josh Brolin, everything goes wrong for him when he makes that decision to take that $2 million. And once he makes that decision, he has sealed his fate. Nothing he could do after that moment would keep him alive. He was dead from that moment onwards. And it's kind of like this biblical sense of you have done wrong and he is coming for you. And I kind of love that. You know, they're so bold in their storytelling. I think they're brilliant.
I still would have taken the money. Sorry.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Flixwater Podcast. Today I'm joined by Will.
Hello.
Kevin.
Hello.
And Helen.
Hello.
And this is No Country for Old Men.
Thank you as always to the Mighty People for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher. Hello, film fans. Joining FlixWatcher remotely today, we have Will and Kevin. If you could please say hello to our listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Hello. Well, I'm Will Collins. I'm a screenwriter and now co-host of the Best Bits Pod. I've written three feature films and a Christmas special. Most recently, I suppose I'd be known for writing Wolfwalkers, the animated feature with Cartoon Saloon, and my previous
Oscar nominated.
Yes.
As we record this, as of yesterday, was it?
Yesterday. So we're in the Oscar running. And previously, before that, I also wrote Song of the Sea with Cartoon Saloon, which was also Oscar nominated. And my first feature was a little independent movie called My Brothers. And I wrote a Christmas special that's on Netflix called Angela's Christmas. That's co-wrote that, actually, as well.
And I'm also a co-host on the Best Bits podcast, but my credits are a little quicker to get through. I wrote one film called Grabbers, which was a monster movie that came out about 8 or 9 years ago now. And I've written 3 episodes of TV, which was based on Neil Gaiman's short stories that was on Sky about 2 years ago, called Likely Stories. And everything else has yet to be produced, which I think is the...
That's kind of how it works for you guys in this industry, isn't it? Unfortunately, especially writers, because you're right at the tip end, mm-hmm. and then everything comes like months afterwards.
Yeah, we're in the sort of research and development stage of filmmaking, so a lot of our work tends to be testing out whether something is viable. So you do a lot of work for stuff that infrequently makes it to screen. But so I'm the grubby sidekick to Will with his 3 films and a Christmas special.
We'd be here a long time if we could list out all the stuff that we created that never got made. So it's just better to just go for the quick list.
I mean, is that just part of the course for you guys? When you advise new screenwriters or script writers, you just say, well, half these things aren't getting made, but it's a journey. enjoy writing.
Yeah.
See light of day.
I remember doing a screenwriting course about 15 years ago by a script doctor named Linda Seeger. And her motto was enjoy the process. And I looked at it and thought, that doesn't sound very encouraging. But no, I know what she means. Enjoy the process.
Mm-hmm. It's so true.
Well, I have seen Grabbers. I saw it. It was in festivals in like 2012.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. It was your man from Coupling was the main thing.
Richard Coyle.
Yeah. And I loved it. I thought it was great.
Oh, cheers. So it was on Netflix.
I thought it was.
because I would have picked it. No.
Just big up your own film. Yeah. Well, tell us a bit about Best Picks podcast and how you got that together and what that's about and why people should listen.
Basically, filmmaking can be quite arduous, as we sort of hinted at there. But films themselves are a lot of fun. Mm. And we sort of just started this podcast to basically tap back into what it was like for us before we sort of broke into the industry or sort of clawed our way in by just being film fans and just talking about the things that we love. So we sort of landed on this concept around Christmas, which was an easy way into films, discussing all different types of films, different genres and what have you, based on different film scenes. And we have a big wheel and we spin it each week and we get a different scene suggestion, like sex scenes, action scenes, musicals, all random stuff, Alan Smithy scenes. And we get together and we just sort of pick and pitch our favorite scenes. And it's a lot of fun. We just sort of get to make each other laugh once a week. And
Isn't it like 350 topics on that wheel or something insane?
There is. And we keep adding to them. Some of them are really daft, like best nude scene. But
that's the gas thing. It's the daft topics that actually open up these wonderful portals that take you down. Like, you know, when you get a topic that you think you'd love to get, like, you know, for me, it was like I got Harrison Ford. And I went, yeah, Harrison Ford. And then when I actually was faced with the task of actually narrowing it down, it was a complete nightmare. But then I got a topic like best Alan Smithy scene, and you go, oh god, that's gonna be a nightmare. But then that's actually loads of fun. You find out loads of interesting information, and I love doing it because it is great crack. And as Kevin was saying, it kind of reconnects us. It was how it all started was through lockdown, when we were having Zoom calls and stuff like that. And you know, lockdown for everyone has been a trudge. But when we're having these calls, we would talk about stuff. Yeah. The only guy
I don't have to see anybody. It's great.
Advocating for lockdown 5 is Kevin Lehan. But yeah, it's great. Like, it is genuinely great crack. And it's kind of, it's like our, it's rejuvenated me in my love for cinema. Not that it was gone, but it just, every week I listen to, if Kevin's hosting, I get him to take me down a wonderful path of joy, of filmic joy. And, that's why I love it. And it's actually very personal as well. That's the weird thing about it. It's become quite kind of autobiographical as well, I've found. So, yeah, it's cool. I love it.
It's quite, film choice does tend to be quite personal, doesn't it, Helen? I guess because we have some people on here who they don't know what they've never watched the film that their partner's chosen. And they hate it. And you can see like the friendship like splitting. Just ever so much, but not because when you find out someone you know, love and trust, you know, for ages doesn't like the film in the same way you do, it's a bit gutting sometimes.
Oh, it's horrible. It's like when you introduce somebody to a film and you try and watch it with them and you just spend time watching their reaction and getting really miffed if they're not like, but that's funny. Why aren't you laughing?
Yeah.
That's, well, turn it off. I don't want to watch anymore.
It never goes the way you hoped.
No, it's the pressure as well. It's like if somebody comes to you and says, you've got to watch this, it's brilliant, you sort of have your hackles up and you think, well,
straight away,
I'll decide whether I think it's good or not.
Well, talking films, we're here to talk about No Country for Old Men, which is
rubbish.
Will.
Rubbish film.
Is this one of those where friendships divide?
No.
And that was the last episode of the Best Bits Pod. Thanks for joining us.
So tell us about No Country for Men, the synopsis in less than 60 seconds, and also why you chose it, Will.
Okay, well, No Country for Old Men was released in 2007, written and directed, well, adapted and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, and it was based on a Cormac McCarthy novel. And it's a very simple plot, really. It's basically about a kind of a retired Army Vietnam vet, but he's not Rambo, he's just like a welder, and he's out hunting one day in the Texas desert, and he randomly comes across a dog that's been wounded, and he follows the dog, and it's kind of like a pit bull type of dog, and he encounters a scene of a massacre in which a drug deal has gone wrong and everyone's dead. And he goes over and he finds the last dude that walked away, but died. And he had a suitcase with him. And in that suitcase was $2 million. So he takes the suitcase. And the story kind of unfolds from there. because he shouldn't have taken a suitcase, and he's been tracked down by a methodical kind of killer called Anton Chigurh, played by Javier Bardem. And it's basically a cat and mouse chase where Josh Brolin's character is evading Javier Bardem, but Javier Bardem is always on his tail. And it's like, it's almost like a Terminator story in one way. But then it takes this incredible turn at the end.
Yeah.
And also we have this other kind of character played by Tommy Lee Jones, who's the sheriff.
I think this is going well over the 60 seconds here, Will.
I love it. I love this film. I love it because my first instinct coming out of this film was, I wasn't satisfied by the story, but not in a I hated that sort of way, but in a what the hell was that about? You know, that ending, the way the story turned in the last, you know, third of the narrative, really I found compelling and confusing. And I know I just wanted to go right back in there and try and figure out what the hell was going on. And I did. I went back in, like, not straight away, but like the next day I went back to watch it in the cinema again. And that's when I fell in love with it, when I actually knew what was coming and I was able to kind of piece it together in my own head. I loved it and I still love it.
And what happened in that sleep at night? Were you trying to piece it together then? And like, was there an epiphany that you came to, or?
Well, it's basically, I was so shocked by the turn that happened in the story that I felt...
We can spoil, so don't be shy.
This is jumping pretty late into stories when Josh Brolin, who has been our hero and the guy we've been rooting for, the guy we want to evade with the money and escape Javier Bardem and hopefully kill Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh, gets brutally gunned down by the Mexican drug gang off camera. Mm-hmm. Off screen, and it's so anticlimactic and anti-heroic and devastating that I just went, oh, what happened? What, my hero that I've been rooting for is gone. And it gutted me. And once I was able to go back in and watch the film from the beginning with that knowledge in my head, I found myself looking for another way of carrying the experience of viewing the film through it. You know, I went in with different lens and I found a different protagonist, and my different protagonist was Tommy Lee Jones, and I rooted myself in him and I went, okay. And once I kind of input my emotional investment in Tommy Lee Jones' character and listened to him a little bit more, then my overall experience with the story was far more gratifying and enriching. And I think I got it once, or I got some message that felt rich for me, anyway, on the second viewing.
See, my protagonist, the one that I closely identified with, was Anton Chigurh. I was rooting for him. So for me, it was a happy ending and I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's a happy ending when you end up with bones sticking out your arm. Is that a good ending for you? Or
He got to walk off into the sunset. I thought that was very heroic. But no. It just defies convention, that film. So like a screenwriter's, you know, it's hard to sort of unpack a film where you go, they are deliberately foregoing three-act structure here and they are breaking the rules deliberately. Yeah. And having to accept that and sort of, read the film in a different context, knowing that it is just all about this unsatisfying sort of pattern to life, that life itself doesn't really make sense. And it's just basically what you can snatch from it and take out of it. It's like with Tommy Lee Jones' dream at the end, I think that sort of sums up the film. There's not really much meaning there. It's just about the feeling that you're left with.
And, was that feeling kind of worsened as a result of, you had some characters like Stephen Root and Woody Harrelson, who are almost bit part players, and they both come in and then just die at the hands of Anton Chigurh. So it's typical film where, you know, I mean, Stephen Root lesser, but if Woody Harrelson's in the film, he comes in halfway through, you think he's going to make more of an impact. And that does kind of sideswipe people, I guess. Helen?
Yeah, I mean, when you see big names on it, I was going to give an example away, which would have been a spoiler, but when you expect them to last at least, I don't know, 20 minutes or so when they come to it, it's always an interesting, you're like, oh, we're gonna play that way, okay. And it kind of makes it exciting because you're like, well, if they could die, anyone could die. So... Yeah. I don't mind that. This isn't... I think I was probably the same when I saw it for the first time. I was like, yeah, not really sure about that. And I'm still not really sure about it myself. I think it probably goes into my middle tier of Coen films. But I enjoyed it more the second time round, but I'm not quite sure why that was, because quite a long time had gone in between them and I hadn't wanted to go back and revisit. I think maybe I maybe invested in the dogs. There's some strong dog acting at the beginning, which I thought was good.
That dog was incredible. He was not letting up. He was really going for it.
Yeah. He turned when he looked back over his shoulder. It was just like, "Whoa, give him the Oscar!" You know, or isn't it like seriously? And he was limping back as well.
Exactly, yeah. That's it. Look back over his shoulder and limp away. And I was like, "Yeah."
But you know what else I love about it is there's no film score in the film, so it just plays like ASMR to me. It's just got this sort of lovely atmosphere that starts off very relaxing and soothing, and you're just sort of aside from the murder. But when you're sort of tracking the hunt with Josh Brolin, and then that sort of absence of a score sort of just heightens the tension. It just becomes unbearably tense, like with that Woody Harrelson scene where he's just sitting there, and it's when the phone rings, it's like your heart jumps out of your chest. It's amazing.
It doesn't manipulate your emotions, because there's no music there to kind of build it up to the something that you're expecting. So that's probably sort of the unexpectedness as well, because there's no musical cues to point you as something is going to happen like this. Oh, is there going to be action next? Is there going to be something scary next? It's just strange.
The thing I noticed that was there, because in this last viewing, the absence of score really stood out to me. But I was listening to kind of see what sort of sound engineering was there to replace that. And what is there is there's a very conscious insertion of the sound of wind. You hear winds blowing across the desert. You hear wind blowing through, like, you know, these not wind vanes anyway, but also like through it, wind blowing through curtains and stuff like that. And there's something, again, it adds a texture and reality to this world that makes this less of a fanciful kind of like entertaining thriller and more of a real kind of like, you know, you're on the edge of your seat feeling that this is real life and this is closer to almost documentary. And where's like, you know, once you take away the artifice of the score, you're kind of like, oh God, this is actually happening and anyone could die and this is real.
Here's a random question for you guys. Do you ever hear music in your dreams?
Oh.
Dreams are always,
I don't know.
You know, just the actual sound of real life. You don't really hear music, I don't think. So I don't know whether that played into it, because, you know, they're very deliberate filmmakers. So that was a definite choice. And I don't know.
I guess I was just enthralled in the film each time I've seen it, that I hadn't twigged. And I think it's kind of testament to the power of the screenplay and the performances that the tension in each tense scene was built up due to what we purely see on screen. And that scene in the petrol station was probably what stuck with me most, because that was a real sense of that real threat that came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. We'd seen him take that guy out at the side of the road, so we knew he was dangerous. We'd seen him kill the police, the cop, but we hadn't really heard him speak and how his mannerisms and how he held himself and how he could it's almost like Two-Face from Batman, isn't it? He just suddenly, like, he was kind of happy Larry, and then he said, well, what's the weather like your way? Where's my way? And that's already, he's pissed off with this guy.
What era was the film set in? Because he's got like a 70s haircut.
It's and 1980.
Those cars are not 1980.
Do you know the reason how I know it's 1980? Because in that scene, he says, when he flips the coin, he says...
22 years.
Yeah, he says, this coin was minted in 1958. It's taken 22 years to get to this moment now.
Okay. Nice.
Maths.
Yeah, there we go. That took me, I was up all night adding those together.
I was like going, wait, no, Josh Brolin was in The Goonies and he was a teenager in The Goonies. He couldn't have been in Vietnam.
That's real. That's not real life, Kevin.
That's how my brain works.
There's so much I love about this. And I suppose on a thematic level as well, there's a kind of there's a connection with a lot of like it's almost like a biblical parable, a moral fable. And one reading into it is that, you know, Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh is death and he is coming inevitably he is coming, whether fate decides it or not. You know, maybe fate will let you off this time, but he will not stop, and he will not be killed, and it's inevitable. That's something you just have to come to terms with. And I love that, because that kind of goes back into stories like Fargo, which is, you know, a huge one for me. Fargo is all about just the greed. But also, there's one thing, another thing I love about the story and the screenwriting of this is that Josh Brolin, everything goes wrong for him when he makes that decision to take that $2 million. And once he makes that decision, he has sealed his fate. There's nothing he could do after that moment would keep him alive. He was dead from that moment onwards. And it's kind of like this biblical sense of, you have done wrong and he is coming for you. And I kind of love that. You know, there's inevitability about it. And, you know, they're so bold in their storytelling. I think they're brilliant.
I still would have taken the money.
I would have taken the money and then checked for a transponder. Transponder and then, you know. Put the transponder in a dog.
I remember seeing this film in the cinema, and obviously everyone was reeling after Josh Brolin was killed. But when Anton Chigurh turned up at Kelly MacDonald's house, there was just this ripple of like, oh, that went right through the cinema of like, oh, don't do this, please. And it's such a brutal sort of end to that character. He just walks out and checks his shoes, like as if he's just walked through dog dirt or whatever. And it's so cruel and so dark. And but the film is also surprisingly funny as well. Like when I was rewatching it for this, I burst out laughing when he says to the guy driving the chicken coop truck, can you get those chicken crates out of the back of that? And he goes, what? And it just does this hard cut to him hosing down the truck, getting rid of all the feathers. You just know he's just after executing that guy. But they're sick individuals, the Coens.
Tommy Lee Jones is like the comic relief in this film. He gets some of the best lines and some of the best stories, especially when playing off with the his deputy. Yeah. But those are some of the funny scenes.
He's got a line that said his deputy says, "Oh, it looks like one hell of a mess," and he says, "Well, if it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here," or something like that. It's a brilliant line. His performance is devastating. I love him.
I loved Woody Harrelson's description of Anton Chigurh as well, which was, how would you describe him? He doesn't have a sense of humor. It's just like, that's a lovely descriptor for this bull-headed Terminator.
So Helen, you said this is mid Coen Brothers. And I think Coen Brothers is probably our most, the Coen Brothers are our director we've featured most in Flixwatch. We've had Fargo, Buster Scruggs.
Burn After Reading.
I love that one as well. Which is a very divisive film.
You weren't so much fun, Helen, were you? But
No.
I enjoyed it a lot more the second time. The first time I didn't get it, but the second time I was just like, this is silly. Let's enjoy the silliness.
How do you feel about Intolerable Cruelty? Has that ever popped up?
It hasn't.
I have to watch it again.
I've never seen it.
I found intolerable, but it's people really love that film. So I'm trying to be convinced, because I usually love all their films. That one just didn't work for me.
Well, this Helen, you're saying it's mid-tier. Go on, sorry.
I was going to say, well, this is largely considered their best film, and the Academy certainly thought so, with four wins for it. So would you say this is their best film?
I'd go Fargo.
Fargo is one of my favorite films of all time, but this is, I will put it in the top tier. Like, it's up in, for me, they've got a pretty packed top tier. So basically, it's in that top bunch for me.
Big Lebowski as well. Sorry, just think about that,
I didn't like that when I first saw it either.
You didn't like Big Lebowski?
No, I don't think I like any of their films the first time I watched them. And it's because they subvert my kind of an innate storytelling brain, and they kind of they screw with me, and the part of my brain goes, hang on a second, why are they making these strange decisions? And then I go back and I go, oh god, they're just they're just they're such masters. They can do whatever the hell they want, and it takes me. I'm like one viewing behind their joke. You know, I'm like that kid has to come back. You know, oh yeah, now I get it. I've left the party and I've got the joke when I'm lying in bed that night. You know, that sort of thing. And but I get it, and I eventually get it, and I love their films. I think they're absolutely master filmmakers.
But if they really this are. Film followed more of a conventional sort of three-act structure, and it became, you know, the big face-off between Brolin and Chigurh, sort of like a rematch from what happened with the shooter at the hotel, I don't think that we'd still be sort of like talking about this film. It's because it sort of swung for the fences, and you know, a lot of that is due to the book as well, and Cormac McCarthy just being a very dark and dour writer, beautiful writer, but very dark subject matter. But I think it is that sort of ambiguous, unsatisfying almost approach to wrapping up the story that you want to unpack it, you want to understand it, you want to mm-hmm. figure it out. You feel like there's something you're not getting, but I just love that about it.
That's what elevates it for me.
Obviously, Will left and had to go back the next day because he couldn't stop thinking about it, even though he didn't like it. And I think that's interesting for storytellers.
I have one question, though, which I still don't understand the motivation of Anton Chigurh, where he is in the hotel room or in the motel room after Josh Brolin's been killed and Tommy Lee Jones turns up, and he's hiding behind the door, isn't he?
I don't think he is. It's a weird cut. I don't think he's in the room. I think he's in another
room.
I wasn't
sure whether he was in the hotel.
I think
next
he might be.
Door.
Do you know like even the gag that Josh Brolin pulled, where he was in like the apartment beside it or behind it or whatever it was. He was able to get access. No, but like we saw the coin and stuff like that. I was confused by that as well. But but if he was in the room, Tommy Lee Jones wouldn't be at the
end. That's just incompetent filmmaking. I think.
Yeah, but they're just fucking with us. That's what they're doing. They love doing that sort of stuff.
Okay, well, let's head to the scores.
Hello, folks. I'm Sam.
And I'm Martin.
And every week for the last 5 years, we've got together to talk about the musician Tom Waits.
He's a gravelly voice singer that sounded like he doused his vocal cords in bourbon and set fire to them with a cigarette and wrote such classic songs as Way Down in the Hole, Downtown Train, Jersey Girl.
He's also the gravelly-voiced actor from films such as The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Seven Psychopaths, both of which, coincidentally, are on Netflix, and both of which Kobe and Helen have discussed here on FlixWatcher.
So make sure you check those episodes out, and when you have a little bit of a taste for the magic that is Tom Waits, why not head over to songbysongpodcast.com or search for Song by Song in your podcatcher of choice to listen to a little bit more about Tom Waits.
So welcome to the FlixWatcher scores. All of the scores are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish. And we'll start with you, please, Will, with the recommendability. So out of 5, how much would you recommend this to people?
The thing about it is I absolutely would recommend this to people, but I would put in, I would give it 5, but I would make sure to give them a caveat that it's a neo-noir Western and it doesn't end. He mightn't have the happy ending that you would expect from a Western. So I would,
Would you tell him that though?
Yeah, I would have to tell my dad. I'd have to tell my dad.
Right.
My dad would it's my dad. And I would say, yeah, you should watch it, but watch out, you know, yeah. So it's a.
I watched this with my dad. It's the last film I saw in the cinema with my dad, actually. I don't know if that put him off, but he loved it. Yeah, I'd probably be similar to Will in that I would have to ask them, do you like the Coen brothers in general? Do you like their darker stuff? If so, then it's a 5. If not, it's a dark film and it's your mileage may vary, but I think it's definitely a 5.
Helen?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because there's no reason that I could legitimately fault it, but at the same time, I just don't get the same kind of enjoyment that I get out of Fargo. I think maybe it's quite a man's film. All of the characters are men. And there's two women of note in there. One of them dies. The other one doesn't. Whereas in Fargo, you've got good old Marge, who's basically the best thing ever. So maybe there's that playing in my mind. And then it is a neo-Western. There is a definite kind of westerny feel about it. It's got horses in it. It's It's got like the border, and my brain is like, I don't do Westerns. So maybe it's like the Westerny thing about it. I'm not really sure. So I think a lot of people would have issues with the kind of hero being killed before the end. I wouldn't recommend it as highly as I would do Fargo. So even though it's not kind of for me, I'd still give it a 4.
I think that's fair.
4.2, I'm going to go for. I think it's the caveat to take it away. And I think, as Helen said, to its detriment, it does kind of skew male, doesn't it? It's
not a crowd pleaser.
No. And that's fine. And there's many of my favourite films, like Donnie Darko, for example, where if you were to say to someone, what's Donnie Darko, without any knowledge of who that person is, then you're a bit of it's unfair, really, yeah. Isn't it? But if you know it's someone who likes kind of slightly acerbic films or off-kilter things, and I think your question is, what do you make of the Coen brothers in general? And if they're positive, then say, yeah, 100%, you should watch No Country for Men. But if their favourite film is, you know,
Titanic,
The Princess Diaries, then you're not going to enjoy this.
Watch Intolerable Cruelty instead.
I have seen that, but I can't remember much about it.
Yeah, it's the Catherine Zeta-Jones one. It's a little bit more glib. It's all the films are kind of glib, but it's their rom-com, really.
It's in their
The only Coen Brothers films that I remember not liking, and not even in a I want to go back and watch this again because I think I'm just not getting it the first time around, was The Ladykillers. And that was the one where I just went, this was just a poor idea.
Okay.
And that's the only one. The rest of them I'm like going, yeah, I'll give every one of these films a go again.
That leads us into repeat viewing score. Will.
Five. Oh God, I've gone every time. I went back the next day. So and I went back and watched it again at the weekend and just went, yeah, I would watch this again next weekend. So it's a 5 for me.
Kevin?
I would say I'll go 4 just because you want to pace it out a little bit, but it's always going to be enjoyable if you do sort of, it's one of those films that if it was on telly, not just on Netflix, but if it was just airing on telly, I would find myself just sitting down and watching it right through to the end again. It just has that hold over me. It's such a captivating sort of mood. 4.
Helen?
I definitely haven't seen it since around 2007, 8-ish. But I did kind of look forward to seeing it again. Maybe I just need a bigger gap, and then maybe if someone suggests it in a few years. I don't know.
Just like 20 years, not 11.
A gap, or there's another reason for me to revisit. So I'm not going to rush out and revisit it, but then it's not the worst thing to watch. I'll go down the middle, 2.5. It's quite long. It's 2 hours. 2 hours of people's heads being blown to pieces with castle guns.
Well, I'm going to go for a 3.8 here. I think it's I hadn't watched it since it first came out. And when it first came out on DVD, when I first saw it, and then it came on Netflix quite recently, like 6 months ago. And I remember on our WhatsApp chat with Helen, I was like, No Country for Men's on Netflix. And I literally like sat, put it down and watched it. I hadn't seen it for a while. And I was really looking forward to it and really enjoyed it. And then you chose again for this, Will. So I watched it. So in the space of 6 months, I watched it twice. Mm. And it's weird that you said the story is quite simple, because I don't think it is. And I forgot about all the different twists and turns and things that happened before then Josh Brolin dies. And this third watch is the first time I realized how he died, because I think I missed the fact that the Mexicans cartel were the ones that took him out. So I think there's different layers to it, and I think it does bear repeat viewing. So 3.8. And before we get to the small screen score, one question I asked before we get to the recording was, Anton Chigurh as a screen villain, guys, you write films. How well drawn out? How interesting is he as a villain?
He's just a force, isn't he? He's not really what he's a haircut, and he is as Will was saying. I think he is death. He's Jaws. He's he's the Terminator. He's just this force of unrelenting doom.
Had you seen Xavier Bardem before this? Javier Bardem.
what was he in before 2007? He was in a few things. I'd definitely seen him before.
Spanish language films.
Yeah, I'd seen some of those, the ones with Penelope Cruz and things. But this was one that cemented him, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd definitely seen him before. I can't tell you what I saw him in at this moment because, you know, time has become a flat circle where... I was shocked that this film came out in 2007, to be honest. I thought it was only like a few years back.
It's weird for me rewatching it. I think he's an amazing in isolation in that film alone. I remember being terrified by him, but I remember the social media storm that kind of, not social, but like, you know, there were so many little videos parodying him. And like there was, I don't know if anyone's seen the YouTube video of that scene in the petrol station where they just like pitched up his voice when he's, when he's telling the petrol attendant to flip the coin, and they just pitched up his voice for the whole scene or whatever it was. And it's hilarious. And so when I'm watching it, when I was watching it the last night, I was like going, oh, the internet kind of ruined his character just a little bit for me. But still, it's what his character does. He is literally a force for an agent of death. And that's what he is, and that's what his purpose in the story is. And I still find that absolutely terrifying. And so, he's brilliant.
Well, interestingly, an article in Business Insider, a group of psychiatrists studied 400 movies and identified 126 psychopathic characters. They chose him as the most clinically accurate portrayal as a psychopath.
Wow.
Out of 400 movies.
He doesn't have a sense of humor, does he?
And you know what? Do you know what blows me away about his character as well on this last viewing was that when he says something, like when he says to Josh Brolin, if you bring the money and put it to my feet, I will not kill your wife. And Josh Brolin doesn't do that. And even though he gets the money, he kills Josh Brolin, he clearly has the money. He still goes and kills Kelly MacDonald. And it's just like, oh my God. Well, at least you know he's going to finish the job. He's not going to walk away. He's committed to his task. And it's terrifying.
Small screen score. Will.
Oh, you can't watch this on a small screen. Basically you should only watch this on the kind of the best screen.
So small screen score is anything that we can watch on Netflix. So we're talking really home TV. So not in the cinema, basically. How good is this at watching it at home, however big your TV screen is?
You need to watch it on the biggest canvas you can possibly get your hands on. And if it means just moving... Yeah, if it means just shoving your chair right up close to the screen, that's what you have to do. So I would say... So am I going to say that it needs to be seen? Because a part of the beauty of this film is that cinematography or those landscapes is the way it's shot. So you really have to get the detail. So I'm going to go with, like, if you have you need a big setup. So 3.5?
Sure. Kevin?
Yeah, it's not really one you want to watch on a smaller screen. Even a laptop, it feels like it's not doing it justice. So I'll say 2. I'm probably throwing off your whole.
No, the score will be the score.
I've never seen this at the cinema, and I think that probably is partly why I haven't got the most out of it. I don't think because there's some bits very near the start with kind of just the way the jeeps, the jeep trucks, American truck things, American trucks. That's what they are. A shot is just like, yeah, this would have looked really great on a cinema. And also 2 self-surgery scenes. I always enjoy a nice bit of self-surgery. And what better than to watch self-surgery on the biggest screen possible? So I'm going to give it a 3 for small screen. If you've seen it before at the cinema, then you can enjoy it on your home screen. But if you haven't, then don't be like me. Hunt it out at the cinema first.
Yeah, I've only ever seen it on the TV screen, so I'd like to see it in the cinema, definitely. So it's going to be let's go 2.5 here for small screen score. Engagement score, Will?
how engaging this film is, and how basically, like Kevin said earlier on, if that film's on, I have to stay with it. I can't. It's like if you switch on Miller's Crossing, I have to stay with Miller's Crossing. It's just like and that's the case with this. If it's on the screen, so it's a 5 for me. I'm totally engaged. And it happened to my wife as a testament. My wife was, I was putting it on at like, she was like, I'm going to bed. And she literally stayed. And she was like, I'm going to bed. But every scene, she was like, no, I'm going now. But no, she just stayed and stayed and stayed. So it's a 5. Absolutely.
Had she seen it before though?
Yeah, we saw it. She was the one who came to me on the second viewing. Okay. So yeah, we saw it in the cinema before.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For me, I could even just listen to the film, not mind just watch it. I just find that the ASMR quality of it just so, captivating and mesmerizing. I'll go 4.9, just to be really awkward.
It's all done on a spreadsheet. That does the maths. It's fine. Helen.
The bits that I'm most engaged are the cat and mouse bits, like the bit before the kind of shootout in the hotel room, like I really, really love. And then when that's removed, my brain's like, not really. My brain has already kind of left the picture. So up until like he kind of is removed from the story, I'm really, really engaged.
When you say he, who do you mean? Sorry.
Sorry, what's his name? Moss.
Josh Brolin.
Is his name Moss?
Moss. Yeah, Josh Brolin's.
Is it Moss? Yeah, him, Josh Brolin, the welder. When he dies, my engagement drops a little bit, so I'm going to go for a 4.
But that's quite close to the end of the film, though, isn't it?
Mm. There's still quite a bit. There's a lot of talking that goes on afterwards.
His first name's
one scene.
His first name's Llewellyn.
Scene between the old guy, who was he?
Oh,
there's loads of old guys in this. This really is an old guy's kind of movie.
Is it the guy where Tommy Lee Jones meets at the end? Yeah. That's Tommy Lee Jones's cousin. That's his Tommy Lee Jones's character's first cousin. Not his real life first cousin that he just decided to call in. But no, his character's first cousin.
Who makes one pot of coffee a week? Shoot him.
For all the cats.
Take the bolt gun to him. That's outrageous.
Get sugar to him. That gives us an overall score of 3.
You haven't done yours.
Oh, yeah, so I'm 5. Oh. Yeah, 5. 5. 3.96250, which is good. It's just good. A dash under. It's the small screen score.
Small screen, and me.
This is where, well, not necessarily you. The small screen score is 2.75, and it's Roger Deakins. And, you know, if he shoots a film that isn't made for the cinema, then what's the point?
Yeah.
So, although I think Fargo is quite good televisually, wasn't it?
Oh yeah.
I saw Fargo on the small screen. That was one I never. I was just a tiny bit too young to see it on a big screen.
It has a 16:9 ratio. It doesn't have that like big panoramic, ratio. So it works well on a small screen.
And also, it's quite muted with all the snow kind of settings. It doesn't kind of stand out in the same way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's 3.96. Sorry, 3.96250. Let's head to Twitter. Everyone do follow us on Twitter. We are at FlixWatcherPod. And the main reason to follow us, as well as our witty banter throughout the week, is before we review a film, we put a shout out, such as this. We're reviewing No Country for Old Men with Willem's film, Kevin Lehane. Sorry, how do you say your name again? Kevin Lehane?
It's at Kevin. No, it's it's Kevin. At Kevin Lehane.
Kevin Lehane. I did say it right-ish. From Best Bits Pod. Have you seen it? Gives your thoughts and a score out of 5 stars from on-air shout-out on FlixWatcher. So it looks like we had a couple of messages. Can you guys see the tweets?
We're reviewing No Country. Lots of retweets. The film that launched Javier Bardem, he completely dominates the film and it's easy to forget there's a gripping thriller behind it. His shining performance. I did have to Google the meaning of Tommy Lee Jones' stories though. 5 sharp cattle bolts to the head.
I've never even thought to Google his stories. This is something I'm going to do as soon as we finish recording.
I don't think anyone can really sum it up, really, because, I was talking to my dad earlier on, and I said, do you remember going to see No Country for Old Men? What did you think of it? And he was like, yeah, it was great. And I said, do you remember how it ends? He's like, no, I don't. But it's Tommy Lee Jones just recounting sort of 2 memories of a dream with his dad. And and then he woke up, and it cuts to black, which is usually one of those things that I absolutely love in films. I really love when a film ends on a close up of a face, and you realize that it's all been about the internal journey for that particular character. But that one mm-hmm. played almost like the end of The Sopranos. It was just sort of like, okay, I'm not clever enough for this. Let me process this. But that's life.
I just feel it's him. It's his character having to come to term with his own mortality and his the realization that there is evil and an unstoppable evil in the world, and it's not just now. It was always there, and there's nothing he can do about it. And I think he's literally coming to terms with his own mortality. I don't think he has come to terms with it. He's in the process of trying to come to terms with it. That's where I feel he's at. And he's retired. It's sad. It's a somber ending. It's a somber ending. And I love it. I love it.
Depending on who you identify with, again, as I say, because for me, my guy walked off into the sunset.
Do you find that as screenwriters, guys, when if people, they don't get a film and you find out they're watching it from maybe the wrong perspective, and when you kind of reframe it, do you find that's how people miss the, I don't know, the power behind a film or a story?
Just personally, I can remember really hating Groundhog Day. I just thought that it was like a story that never really got going. And then I realized that I was an idiot and I watched it with a more developed brain. And it was a masterpiece. So, you know, some films need to settle with you, and you need to sort of, they need to sort of, you know, percolate within the zeitgeist. And, film is subjective, isn't it? No matter what, mm-hmm. it's like music. Somebody's favorite song is another person's like nails on a chalkboard. So, each their own. You either like it, you don't like it. Life is short. What you like.
I'm aware that taste grows and changes as we get older, and we bring so much of ourselves into each screening of each time we watch anything. So I've read so many reviews of stuff, but I've also sat through films that I just didn't enjoy in one particular instance, and then revisited them years later and just went, wow, that's amazing, just like Kevin said there. But I know in my head that if there's something that maybe I'm not getting out, it does tickle something in the back of my brain that's like nudging me to go back and revisit it again. That maybe I'm not in the right space. I haven't, my tastes haven't developed well enough, but I feel like, I'll get there in time,
This might not be, worth for the podcast, but I remember talking to my uncle when I was a teenager and we having this debate where I said, you need to be in the right mindset to watch this particular comedy. And he said, no, a good comedy should work regardless. It's the comedy should make you laugh. You don't need to be in the mindset to enjoy a certain film. It's the film itself has to do the work. And I don't really know where I come down on that still. But
I think sometimes that's where the cinematic experience really works, because if you go into cinema, it's you go through those doors to sit down into a darkened room, and now it's the time to watch this film. And if film doesn't play in that circumstance, then it's, that's the thing. But I think if a film resonates when you're at home with like birds tweeting around and Twitter's on and you can go to a toilet and pause, then that's a different kind of experience, isn't it?
You're triggering a memory there for me, which is the one film where I can sort of like, do a litmus test was my own film, Grabbers. When that was coming out, we saw that repetitively during its run up to its release, and you're seeing it with different audiences, and the film just felt different depending on the energy within the room. And sometimes the film played like gangbusters, and other times it was very muted, and it was the exact same film, even the exact same screening, the cinema itself, but it was just the energy that came into the room was slightly different, and so the film itself just was transmogrified by that. It was bizarre, but
Well, this is the after Twitter segment of the FlixWatcher podcast. Guys, we'll leave everything there. Let us know where we can find you online and say sayonara to the listeners.
You can find us on Best Bits Pod on Twitter and under our own individual handles at Kevin Leanne and Will.
I'm at Willems Film, WillumsFilm.
Well, that's very rhythmic.
That's Tilagal.
Thank you very much for joining us, guys.
Radio, cheers. Thanks for having us. Bye bye.
Sayonara.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell them FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.